Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. We're on every second Saturday at 4 to 6 Eastern Time. I normally am coming through from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, where I live, but today I'm on the road. I've been on taking a road trip. You may hear the motorcycles go by in the background, and I'm on my cell phone here at the moment, overlooking a wide expanse. I think I can see for 10 to 20 miles over the Georgian Bay and beautiful islands and beautiful Canadian countryside in front of me here. So I'm on my cell phone, and we're hoping that we're not going to have problems with the cell phone today. And if we lose contact with me, then Don at the station is going to get right back, and you just hold on, and hopefully we'll be able to reestablish connection. This is a Zero Point Show, and as I've said many times before, the concept of Zero Point is taken from Blavatsky's work, and the concept is that any living being has a first point, an original point source, origin. So each human being has a zero point center connected to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. So Jim and I actually tried to explain an alternate model of human existence from what's predominant in modern science. We consider that scientists have made major mistakes in assuming that the brain in the head produces human consciousness, whereas our experience and studies have led us to believe in what we call the heart doctrine, that consciousness and the individual I experience originate out of the depths of the heart. And we find this teaching throughout different mystical traditions, from Christianity to Kabbalah, yogic Vedic teachings. The Dalai Lama teaches about this. He calls it the indestructible drop within the heart, as well as numerous other mystical sources. So our explorations are of human consciousness and the nature of multidimensional existence. Because Jim and I believe that we as beings are multidimensional beings, and that in a sense there is an I which inhabits the body. The living entity in the human being is not produced by the body, but rather the I, or the spiritual self, inhabits the body. And that death is not the end of life. And that we, in our lives, we need to strive in some way to attain our souls and to attain this mystical knowledge of the self. And one of my favorite expressions is a Jewish expression which says that the truth is under our noses all the time. And I think that's a really cute way of talking about the heart doctrine, because the heart is right under your nose the whole time. And you can go searching everywhere in the world around you seeking God, but then you're most likely to find him in his only place within your own heart. So Jim and I explore the mysteries of consciousness and the heart and alternate models of the structure of human existence and afterlife planes and such subjects. Now, I would encourage people to have a look at my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and it's all spelled out zeropoint.ca. And I'm going to just bring my co-host on, and then I'll get back and give some background as to what I'm doing at the moment and some comment on my travels and such. Jim, how are you?
Oh, I'm good, Chris. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you well, Jim. Jim's in Toronto, Ontario. Have you had any holiday this summer, Jim?
I haven't had a holiday since forever. You seem a little bit distant. Can you talk a little bit closer? Because I think we had better sound before when you were a little closer.
My mouth is about 2 inches from the telephone.
Okay. All right.
We'll have to try to make do. I hope the cell phone maintains a connection. It may not, because I have it on speakerphone.
Oh, okay.
I don't think I can put this against my head for 2 hours.
Yeah. That's why it, because you can tell it's a speaker. I thought it was a speaker. Vacations. No, I haven't had a vacation for, a real vacation for about 12 years, I realized the other day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that reminds me of when I left corrections, working as a correctional psychologist. I realized one day that I hadn't had more than a week off in 12 years. And when I left corrections, it's like I've never gotten back into a regular job situation. So I've been very fortunate to be able to live more freely, which has enabled me to produce my books and such. I hope sometime, Jim, you'll have more time in your life and you can finish up your books, because you got about four or five books there now, at least.
Yeah.
Even more.
Five. Yeah, almost five. Yeah, almost five. And I really want to... I have a couple of other volumes that I definitely want to write. Like, I right now I've got one that I'm almost finished, and then a second volume in The Problem of God's Contracting Universe about your work and about our work and about the challenge that you described in the opening remarks. And then I want, there's another book that I want to do. And I definitely, there's several different books that I want to complete. I realized when you said that, I haven't had 2 weeks off for 20 years. I think the last time I had 2 weeks off was in 1992 when I went to, England in June of 1992.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I take that back. I was unemployed for 7 months. So.
That kind of doesn't count, because then you don't really have the, you can't go traveling unless
It was fun. It worked out. I mean, it cost me a fortune. I'm still sort of paying for it, but it was such a great break. I felt so good when I had that break from working. It was just, then actually, that's when I started The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. I wrote a ton, about a 5 month period, I wrote probably 2/3 of the book I wrote, and then I've just been reworking it ever since, and that was like 3 years ago, So, yeah, it's weird how. I just realized that, I'm just trying to get to the point now in the next, year of my life where I only work 4 days a week, because it makes a huge difference. I just want to have that extra time to work on my writing. But the big thing is just I haven't had an office job for 35 years and a 9-to-5 job until the last 3 years of my life, and it really cuts into your reading time and your writing time. So I'm not really into this kind of normal existence. Doesn't suit my purposes very well. But
Yeah,
so where are you?
I'll come to that in a minute. I was going to say a little bit about my travels here and a little bit about that. I had a thought. I was just going to. Oh yeah, so we're talking about holidays. Oh, I was going to say, today is August 6th, and it's actually 3 months since my sweetheart passed away, Karen. And people who've been following us on the show would know that Karen had been my girlfriend and spiritual warrior companion for years, and she died 3 months ago. So I'm still kind of going through the process of grieving over that and trying to find new direction in my life. Actually, I'm not seeking to find new direction at the moment, because I'm more completing the things that I've been doing during my time with Karen, and I have a new book, which I hope is going to be ready before the end of August, and it's called Zero Point Teachings. And the main item in this book is a series of articles I had published in the Journal of Esoteric Studies on the origins and nature of human consciousness. But it also includes a variety of my writings on issues related to consciousness and the mind and paranormal phenomena, articles that I had up on my website. So I'm hoping that'll be out in the end of August, and by the end of September, I hope to come out with this book, which Jim and I'll talk about later, The God's Contracting Universe, which sounds like Jim's book, and we'll kind of talk about that later in our show today. Those are my current projects, as well as I'm hoping when I get back from my trip at the moment to revise my website. And it is last Monday. I guess I'd been home 3 months. Oh, I was going to say, what reminded me about Karen was thinking, Jim, when I met Karen, Karen was such high maintenance. I couldn't ever have had a regular job and maintained the relationship. She couldn't live like that. She just couldn't do it. It was so funny, you know. She was so unstructured, and so it was quite a switch in my life going from, you know, being really part of the system as a psychologist in corrections to being an independent writer and researcher. And it's been a struggle. And ongoing struggle. So anyway, I had the opportunity. I've been at home the last couple of months, mainly putting my other energies into a big vegetable garden I have going and trying to continue with my writing and work. And I had the opportunity last Monday to go on a road trip with a friend of my housemate, Kenny. Remember Kenny? Jimmy sang those really nice songs. We're going to get Kenny back on to sing again in a week or two. Anyway, Kenny's friend, Stephanie, and a younger woman, and she had two children who she needed to deliver up past Thunder Bay, almost to the province of Manitoba. So we set off on Monday morning with two children, and it's been quite a trip. We covered over 2,000 kilometers in the 2 days and delivered the kids on time. And then after that, we travel back to Thunder Bay, which is on the north shore of Lake Superior. And we camped at this kind of provincial park there, which was absolutely beautiful. Deer all around us in the woods. We went down to the beach at night, and all of a sudden we found there were all these deers coming out of the forest. It was really quite amazing. And I must say, driving, we've driven a long way across Canada. We put almost 4,000 kilometers on now. And what a beautiful country this is. Unbelievably beautiful country Canada is. And the cleanliness of the highways and the roads and just the natural beauty of the mountains and so much fresh water. So it's been really nice for me to kind of try to get out of my sorrow a bit and kind of, you know, get out into the world. And it's really been quite an adventure and fun. And yeah, so I'm hoping we're headed back towards Ottawa tomorrow, and I'll probably be back within a day or two. So it's been a very interesting trip, and I'm going to have a new section on my website. I'm going to put some pictures from the trip up there, do some new pictures of myself. I've got very long hair at the moment. A lot of people think I'm native. Oh, Jim, you wouldn't have seen. I treated myself. I bought this most beautiful native Indian drum. Oh, it's such a nice, rich sound to it. And, I've been out a little bit on the beach and working with the drum. I've got to learn a little bit more about looking after a drum and how to smudge it and look after it and such. But anyway, so we've been traveling along and swimming, and I'm just so taken by the beauty of Canada as a nation. And it's amazing how we drove almost 2,000 kilometers, and almost along the whole way, there are hardly any cities and towns. It's like, where are the people? It's like such a vast country. It really is. And the cities are like smaller and far, few and far between. Incredibly beautiful country. And it's nice to kind of restore my connection with nature again. So what was I trying to come to? the one thing that's disconcerting a little bit is that being on the road so much and being outside is I've been very aware of chemtrail spraying. And it was funny because when we came across from Ottawa to the end of Lake Superior, there was heavy, heavy chemtrailing up by North Bay and Petawawa and the Ottawa area. But then there was hardly any chemtrailing across the province until we came back to the area where we are now. At the moment, I'm looking out over northern Georgian Bay on an island called Manitoulin Island, which is kind of beaches and campsites and a lot of natives on the island. It's really very, very beautiful. And so that's where I am at the moment. And it was funny because yesterday, all of a sudden during the day, they started chemtrails spraying us so heavily, unbelievably heavy. I don't think I've ever seen such heavy chemtrail spraying, except on YouTube where people document it. And it just went on all afternoon and evening yesterday, and again here today. And I look around me now in the clouds. All the clouds almost that I see are chemtrail clouds. And it's been really interesting being outside so much, because I followed the chemtrails, and then I've been trying to study how they form into clouds, like how to distinguish chemtrail clouds from regular clouds. And that's been interesting. And it's interesting also how you see different wave fronts get set up in the chemtrail clouds, and it looks like ripples of water. And I can see the chemtrail clouds are responsive to that in a manner that the cumulus clouds are not. Anyway, those are a few of my observations. I'm going to put some pictures of the chemtrails up on my website. My website at the moment, if you go to, I think from the author's page, you'll see my little article on the chemtrail poisoning of the citizens of Kempville and Ottawa. Because I feel like seeing the beauty of this country and seeing this being done in the skies above us, I feel such moral outrage at this being done, and I don't know how to deal with it. It seems nobody does, because people are awake, have woken up to this, many, many millions of people now, and it seems so helpless at times. I don't know where we can turn to deal with these horrendous problems. So that's been interesting. Jim, as a treat, the other evening, Stephanie read a passage from a book she was reading, and she read it so interestingly that I thought maybe today I'm going to get her to read this chapter. So it'll just take 5 minutes, and I hope the sound comes across okay. It's from a book called No Wonder They Call Him the Savior by Max Lucado. Okay, so, and the chapter that Stephanie's going to read is called The Ten Who Ran.
There is something striking in the simple fact that the disciples got together again. I mean, they have been embarrassed. As they sat gawking at each other that Sunday, they must have felt a bit foolish. Only two nights earlier in the kitchen had gotten hot and they had taken off. It was as if someone threw a pan of scalding water on a bunch of cats. Bam! Off they scampered. They didn't stop until they had ducked into every available hole in Jerusalem. Have you ever wondered what the disciples did that weekend? I have. I've wondered if any walked the streets or thought of going home. I've wondered what they said when people asked them what happened. Well, you see, I wondered if they stayed in pairs or small groups or alone. I've wondered what they thought, what they felt. We had to run. They would have killed us all. I don't understand what happened. I let him down. He should have warned us. I have wondered where they were when the sky turned black. I've wondered where they near the temple when the curtain ripped, or near the cemetery when the graves opened. I've wondered if any of them even dared to sneak back up to the hillside and stand at the edge of the crowd and stare at the three silhouettes on the hill. No one knows. Those hours are left to speculation. Any guilt, any fear, any doubts are all unrecorded. But we do know one thing. They came back, slowly. One by one, they came back. Matthew, Nathaniel, Andrew, they came out of hiding, out of the shadows. James, Peter, Thaddeus, perhaps some were already on their way home, back to Galilee. But they turned around and came back. Perhaps others had given up in disgust, but they changed their minds. Maybe others were flooded with shame, but still they returned. One by one, they appeared at the same upper room. They must have been relieved to see others already there. From all sections of the city, they appeared, too convicted to go home, yet too confused to go on. Each with a desperate hope that it had all been a nightmare or a cruel joke. Each hoping to find some kind of solace in numbers. they came back. Something in their nature refused to let them give up. Something in those words spoken by the Master pulled them back together. It certainly was an awkward position in which to be, caught on that uneven ground between failure and forgiveness, suspended somewhere between I can't believe I did it and I'll never do it again. Too ashamed to ask for forgiveness, yet too loyal to give up. Too guilty to be counted in, but too faithful to be counted out. I guess we've all been there. I dare say that all of us have witnessed our sandcastle promises swept away by the pouncing waves of panic and insecurity. I imagine that all of us have seen our words of promise and obedience ripped into ribbons by the chainsaw of fear and fright. And I haven't met a person yet who hasn't done the very thing he swore he would never do. We've all walked the street of Jerusalem, the streets of Jerusalem. Why did the disciples come back? What made them return? Rumors of the resurrection. That had to be part of it. Those who walked next to Jesus had learned to expect him to do the unusual. They had seen him forgive a woman who had five husbands, honor a pint-sized thief disguised as a tax collector, and love a streetwalker whose reputation would have brought blushes to the face of Bonnie and Clyde. They'd seen him scare the devil out of some demoniacs and put the fear of God in some churchgoers. Traditions had tumbled, lepers had leaped, sinners had sunk, Pharisees had fumed, multitudes had been moved. You just don't pack up the bags and go home after 3 years like that. Maybe he really had risen from the dead, but it was more than just rumors of an empty tomb that brought them back. There was something in their hearts that wouldn't let them live with their betrayal. For as responsible as their excuses were, they weren't good enough to erase the bottom line of the story. They had betrayed their master. When Jesus needed them, they had scampered, and now they were having to deal with the shame, seeking forgiveness but not knowing where to look for it. They came back. They gravitated to that same upper room that contained the sweet memories of a broken bread and symbolic wine. The simple fact that they returned says something about their leader. It says something about Jesus, that those who knew him best could not stand to be in his disfavor. For the original 12 there were only two options, surrender or suicide. Yet it also says something about Jesus that those who knew him best knew that although they had done exactly what they had promised they wouldn't, they could still find forgiveness. So they came back, each with a scrapbook full of memories and a thin thread of hope, each knowing that it is all over, but in his heart hoping that the impossible will happen once more. If I had just one more chance. There they sat. What little conversation there is focused on the rumors of an empty tomb. Someone sighs. Someone locks the door. Someone shuffles his feet. And just when the gloom gets good and thick, just when their wishful thinking is falling victim to logic, just when someone says, how I'd give my immortal soul to see him one more time, a familiar face walks through the wall. My, what an ending. Or better said, what a beginning. Don't miss the promise unveiled in this story. For those of us who, like the apostles, have turned and run when we should have stood and fought, this passage is pregnant with hope. And repentant heart is all he demands. Come out of the shadows. Be done with your hiding. A repentant heart is enough to summon the Son of God himself to walk through our walls of guilt and shame. He who forgave his followers stands ready to forgive the rest of us. All we have to do is come back. No wonder they call him the Savior.
That's the end of the reading. Thank you, Stephanie. Were you able to hear it, Jim?
Yeah,
great. Yeah, the moving passage from this book, Christian book, and yeah, I was quite taken by it. And Stephanie is such a good reader. She read it with such a cadence the first time I heard it, I was so taken by it. And it was funny because I met her children, and before they went on their trip, Stephanie had written out a big list, typed out a list of the things they needed to take packing. And when she came over with the children to visit me, the youngest wanted to read the list of the things he had to pack. And he read the whole list through, including words like pajamas. And he read very, very well. And then when he was finished, I said, oh, boy, you can really read well. And then his brother piped up and said, yeah, next year he goes into senior kindergarten. And this boy and I would say, oh, that's funny. He could go to kindergarten and he could read the children their stories. Reminds me of that book where they say everything you learned by kindergarten. Do you know the title of that book?
All I ever needed to know, I learned in kindergarten, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, Stephanie's saying the same thing.
Yeah,
it's amazing. For me, it was interesting being read to. And I realize how, as adults, it's like one doesn't usually hear people read something like that. It inspired me. I wondered, wow, would it ever be neat to hear Beelzebub's tales to his grandson read out loud?
Well, I mean, what he says that you should read it three times, and the second time you should read it as if you are reading it aloud to someone else.
Oh, yeah, that's right. To read it aloud.
There are different things like that are very powerful when they're read aloud. I think they take on a different meaning.
Especially
if they're intended to be read aloud. So certain things are written to be are intended to be read aloud.
Well, I'm going to be back in Kempville in a couple of days, and I'm going to put a series of new photos and pictures up on my website, and I'm going to do more documentation of chemtrails. I'm just so concerned about this as an issue, and I think it's an issue that the evidences are right before people's eyes. Like, it shocks me going around and trying to persuade people that we're being sprayed from the air, and as people can't conceive how that could be possible or what possible motive. They can't. And it always reminds me of Henry Mackau's book, a quote in his book, The Illuminati. He says, the individual is handicapped by coming face to face with a conspiracy so monstrous he cannot believe it exists. And I sit here at the moment looking at a sky completely filled with chemtrails and is like, what's going on? And it's so shocking how we have no public officials, no one who will address these issues. And people, at least, we need to have responsible governments that will kind of deal with this and address this issue honestly. And it seems just no one's willing to do that. It's really disheartening. I think the impact of experiencing all the beauty we saw traveling across Canada and the waters and the animals and the mountains and trees, all that beauty, and then to kind of look up in the skies and just seeing the despoiling the environment through these chemtrails, I'm just more and more taken by this phenomena and think that we just have to address this. I went to a public meeting the other day, a group in Kempville who are associated with the UN Sustainability Program. And what was I going to say about that? I'm losing my train of thought. Well, I think this is, it's funny how the Green movement, like in Canada, we have a Green Party. Why don't the Green Party, why don't they bring up chemtrails? It's like all to me, it seems all the political parties are controlled by what I see as a criminal cabal that's essentially hijacked our governments in favor of the international corporations and banksters. And it's so sad because I found that, like in our travels, most people are like really decent, good people, friendly people, and in the campgrounds, it's just really friendly. It's such a good, I don't know, I felt proud of being Canadian in these travels, like the beauty of the country and the goodness of the people we meet. And yet this is going on all the time. So that's a bit of the contrast, one of the things I feel strongly in traveling here. But besides that, for me, it's been wonderful to kind of get out of my home after a few months of mourning and trying to put my life back together a bit. Karen's passing was very sudden and tragic in ways because she was such a good and noble heart, and we had been through a lot. A lot of things I've never really talked about that we went through over the past 5 years after waking up, and I know it was a huge strain on her as it had been on me and led us both into periods of confusion and fearfulness and anxiety and other periods of ecstasy and illumination. But those were lesser than the periods of concern that we faced. And I know we were both so upset, like trying to wake people up, and it's like everybody's asleep. Everybody's so concerned with men playing games with balls and watching TV. And it's like, don't you care? Like, you're being sprayed, and your children and your grandchildren. And I was going to mention, I went to this meeting, and the friend I went with, it turned out he had three parents with Alzheimer's, and my father had Alzheimer's. So many people in our community have Alzheimer's. And the rates, I believe, are like 10 times what they were 20 years ago. And what's a major cause of Alzheimer's, a potential cause, is the accumulation of aluminum, which is a neurotoxin and is the main ingredient of chemtrails. So this is an issue which I'm going to continue to research. When I get back, I'm going to develop my website on the chemtrail poisoning of the citizens of Kempville, and I'm going to do it for the chemtrail poisoning of the citizens of Ottawa and the chemtrail poisoning of the residents of Manitoulin Island. I'd like to go coast to coast filming chemtrails and dropping off DVDs waking people up to this issue. I just really see it as profoundly important. And I think, Jim, I know you're not as sure about this program as I feel I am, and have some reservations about it. But I mean, you must by now see this going on a fair bit in your skies, do you not?
I live in a city; you can't see anything. It's hard to see. I live in a huge city with a lot of air pollution. You know,
yeah,
it's very hard to see. I've seen trails, but I don't know what they are, and I definitely don't believe that. You know, I don't know what the program is. I mean, I think people spray things, for sure they spray things, but what the purpose is of it, or whether it's one thing or if it's multiple things, like, you know, those are huge leaps. And I completely disagree with the whole proposition that somebody is, some elite somewhere, is intent on reducing the world's population. I just think that's ridiculous. There's no friggin' evidence for it. Population of the world is expanding.
They even say it in their own writings, Jim. It's in UN
Agenda. No, but Chris, the bottom line is that the population, people can say things, but the population of the world is increasing exponentially. The only place on the earth that I know of, the only country where there's a rigorous population control program, is in China. The government mandates that you can only have one child, and you know, and the bigger issue is kind of what happens to female children, but I just don't see that. I think, you know, I've read stuff on the internet, and I've looked at it, and it's like a lot of it's just complete bullshit. It's just nonsense. Like, I mean, I read quotes from people, and they just make things up. It's like you say, look at the world's population. It's not decreasing. It's not stable. It's increasing exponentially. It just is.
It's what? It's
increasing exponentially.
I mean, I wonder at times of that also, because I who's our news sources for what the population is?
Well, but, you know, I mean, I mean, it's just like, you know, I mean, the evidence is just overwhelming that it is. You just look, I mean, even just look at the growth of the size of cities. Look at Ottawa, look at Toronto, like, you know, look at these places in Canada. I mean, look at anywhere in the world. I mean, the population of a place like Mexico City or Mumbai, or, you know, I mean, it's just like, there's major, major things in terms of the increase of the population that have affected the entire world, affected everything, affected the ecology, affected the weather. Like, I mean, it's, you know, this massive urbanization on the planet, along with an incredible increase in population and an incredible increase in the use of resources, and all of those things that, and, I mean, in addition to chemtrails, just all of the things that we use in our lives that create pollution of all sorts, that go into the groundwater, that go into the air, you know, like, I mean, it's just, you have this enormously complex thing going on the planet, and I think it's really simplistic and like, it's just kind of self-serving to just say, well, you know, these problems are caused by some elite that has these, you know, horrible purposes. There are elites with all sorts of horrible purposes. I just don't think it's as I don't think it's as uniform, and I just don't see the evidence for it. The population control thing, I just don't agree with it. I think it's wrong, and in fact, I think it's really wrong. You know, I don't see it.
Well, you don't think they're trying to reduce population?
No.
Were you not aware of earlier in this year where they had that big meeting of Bill Gates and Oprah Winfrey and William Buffett and these people about the overpopulation issue?
Yeah, I distinguish that from trying to reduce the population. It's like I believe in zero population growth. I think that population should be controlled. I think there's too many people on the planet. That's, I think, one of the biggest problems on the planet.
Yeah, but I think you would advocate reducing population through things like birth control and planned families.
Yeah, exactly.
Not through kind of spraying people from the air. But
well, Oprah Winfrey doesn't want to spray people from the air, you know.
Even with regards to chemtrails, I think it is a really complex subject, and I agree with your comment about I think there are multiple purposes to it. And that's why I say, like, I'm studying it as an issue, eh?
Yeah, and I think that's really wise, because I think it has to be studied. Because, I mean, it could be all sorts of things to do with agriculture. I mean, that's what I'm most distrustful about spraying, is that I think it's related to agriculture and to agribusiness. I think there's probably some sort of very insidious agenda behind spraying with regard to that. Like, because, you know, it's linked to genetic crops and genetic modified food and everything. And it's like, you know, these huge
businesses. Well, that's why people say is that Monsanto has come out with these seed lines that will grow in alkaline soil, like soil that has a high accumulation.
Yeah, so,
be related to something like that. I mean,
believable. You know, I do believe that. You know, like, but that makes complete sense to me. Is I wouldn't put anything past Monsanto.
Yeah. The kind of demon company. It's
yeah,
shocking.
A major criminal organization. You know, like, I mean, plain and simple.
I see in the States, I saw an article that there a number of organic farmers, apparently like 250,000 organic farmers, had ganged up together to take Monsanto to court. Had you heard a mention of that anywhere?
Yeah. Well, I think this has been going on for quite a while. It's like it's very, very difficult, eh? Like, because they've had these battles before, like, you know, because of the contamination of people's crops, eh, by their seed and just the whole battle over control of, you know, of seeds is incredible.
Yeah.
Very, very complex topic, but very, as I say, Monsanto is a very, there's nothing at all redeeming about Monsanto. They're a very evil corporation as far as I'm concerned. Like, you know,
yeah, it's very tragic. It's very tragic. I mean, they go all the way back to Vietnam. Didn't they manufacture the Agent Orange?
Yeah.
Defoliation of
Vietnam.
Actually,
I don't know if they did. I thought maybe that might have been Dow Chemical, but it could have been Monsanto. I'm not really sure about that.
Motorcycle went by. Yeah, Jimmy, you there?
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, we won't stick too long on chemtrails. I would encourage people to be looking into it and watching your skies. And I think your point's really good that when you live in the city, I guess that was what struck me about traveling and being in the van all the time and watching the sky and knowing about chemtrails. Then, like, it became more and more evident and clear to me. Because I was out of the city and under the open skies, and it made a big difference. So anyway, I've got some good documentation of chemtrails, which I'm going to put up on my website. And I'm also working as a DVD. I've bought a video camera, and I hope to start putting my work on into videos and putting it up on YouTube. Because I've got to do more to promote my books. My books really aren't selling as they should in the sense of because I think they're important books and you know they've not caught on. I realize I have to do more to promote my work. So I see a new phase a little bit coming up in the future, and me getting out from behind. Once I have these two books done, I'm going to kind of get out from behind the computer and hopefully get into some music and videos and alternate kind of media sources or forms.
It's difficult when you're an independent writer and you can publish books as you have and put them out, and they're available on Amazon and people can get them. And you know, that in the old pre-internet days, that was the access problem was a huge problem. But now that it's still the same problem. There's still a major problem with being an independent writer is just getting your work known and talked about you know, that alerting people to the fact that it exists, like it's difficult.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way, the internet is fantastic because we're broadcasting on the internet, and people could be listening to us in Melbourne or Vienna or North Dakota, there's interest in various. You can collapse all of the boundaries of the world, but at the same time, it's like, you know, if you want to get people interested in your work, it's just very, very difficult to. There's so many competing interests out there, and there's so much information about so many different things, and to draw people's attention to it is the hard part, eh?
Exactly. And that's, I haven't put my head to that yet, my mind to that, energies yet, because, you know, it's just focusing. I had these six books 2 years ago. I had none of them in trade paperback format. And now I have four done, completed, and two more within 2 months. So
right.
It's like I've got, it's like finishing up work, which I've worked at over the last 30 years, and finally getting it in printed form. But then the next step, yeah, I've got to kind of problem solve. How do I promote my books? And so that's coming up. I haven't figured it out yet. One step at a time.
Yeah, it's interesting when you're writing, and especially with this work, because it's not like a novel where you complete it and then the story's told and you move on. You write another novel, because it's like you're always reworking things and your understanding is always evolving and. You know, most of your books have gone through repeated revisions and updates, and it's quite a dynamic. It's an interesting process, but it's an interesting how you can kind of come back to things and you know, have new insights into them, and that's the sort of the dynamic nature of the study of esotericism and this approach to the study of consciousness and the kind of the issues that we're trying to discuss here I see that with my own work is how, like, you know, I want to go back and kind of rework my own writings about. I wrote a book about Gurdjieff and called An Alien Intelligence, and I've been reading a book by Paul Beekman Taylor called Gurdjieff, A New Life, which came out a few years ago, and he has access to information that updated information I think from declassified archives from the Soviet Union and also he's very thorough, very scholarly, and he came out of the Gurdjieff work. His mother was in the Gurdjieff work, and he kind of clarifies a lot of the misconceptions that occurred in the earlier biographies by Webb and by Moore, and in some of the writings of people like C.S. Knott and Fritz Peters, how they got dates wrong and things wrong. Very interesting reading him, so when I read that, I thought, well, you know, gee, I reading that book made me want to go back and sort of rework my own book and make some corrections to it, but also, like, you know, my understanding kind of the issue of Gurdjieff, because I've been thinking about him and writing about him in The Problem of God's Contracting Universe and just trying to understand who he was. My understanding keeps changing all the time. I have new things to sort of say about that issue. It's very interesting. Everything so dynamic in this work. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's like you say, my books are different from a novel. Like, I worked at that Heart Doctrine book. You know, I had some of that done in the early 80s, so it was like 30 years ago almost. And it's because of that refinement through the years. I remember you saying to me, it's like the content of the book is like so profound, you have to have, it has to be written in a form that does justice to the subject matter.
Yeah.
And it took such a revision. Like, I can see why, you know, people in our line of work, in a way, they're more likely to have things produced when they're older. Like they say, mathematicians, you know, the prime time for mathematicians is like early 20s or something. But it's different in the area, I think, of religion and philosophy.
Yeah, I think it's like if you haven't done it by the time you're 33 or something like that, or like your early 30s in math and physics, that you're never going to do it, sort of. It's like, you know, exactly. It's because there's such an ongoing process of an accumulation of information and then refinement of your understanding of it. It's one thing to know it. It's quite a different thing to understand it. I think with my own study of the Fourth Way and various esoteric teachings, I think it took me a long time to be able to go from... I knew things when I was younger, but it took me a long time to understand them and then to write them from myself. I was more just sort of parroting what I'd read and, you know, doing an exposition of other people's accounts of things. And then at one point, I just decided sort of to start over again with my first book, and I just tried to write it for myself. And I was actually, oddly enough, was when I came back from England in 1992, and I just realized I'm going to tell this my way. And now I don't think I had that much more knowledge, but I think I had a very different understanding. I'd sort of had more experience with things, and I'd worked through things more in my own life and talking with you and experiences with other people and other groups of people talking about these things. And I just sort of came to a very different place. And I don't think I knew that much more, but I definitely understood it in a very different way.
Yeah, I think I've learned more through the years to write from myself. Well, I guess previously I had so much material that I was always reworking that it prevented me from writing from myself. And it was nicer later to get back, you know, once I've kind of finished that, then come back to just writing from myself more. It's so much easier. I do hope that you get some of your books into print, though, soon. You know, you could work up, like, Alien Intelligence. You could self-publish that, and it still doesn't preclude you from getting a publisher because you maintain all your copyrights. And
right.
All you do is send the publishers a copy of your book instead of sending them an unfinished manuscript.
I'm just, as soon as I finish this volume, that's my next priority, is just to go back and rework that. I just want to add a little, you know, I just want to tweak it a bit. I don't really want to change it. It's pretty much, I could publish it as is. There are a few things I've learned that I know I was wrong about, or that, there's been a couple of words come out that I want to respond to a little bit about in terms of Gurdjieff, but it's pretty much done.
Your book on Gurdjieff was quite unique because one aspect of it was your own application of the teaching and your own observations in your own life, especially in your autobiography,
I Know My Own Well.
It's quite unique in how you describe, like, your own and my, like, what we went through in our early period of discovering the Gurdjieff teaching and applying it and all the insights that occurred to us. I think your book on Gurdjieff is quite unique in that. I've not seen anything comparable. I think
there are elements in other people's books, but I think, I think the emphasis in my book is a little bit different. And that's my first book, but I'll Know My Song Well. And that's the one it's a huge book. I've been basically deconstructing it ever since I wrote it. It took me 20 years to write it, and it's really three books in one book. I was actually thinking about different ways. I've been thinking a lot about it the last couple of years, about how to go back and rework it, based on some comments I've gotten from people who weren't particularly informed or knew anything about the Fourth Way. And I think people responded to a lot of the more practical applications rather than the theoretical material. So I was thinking of going different ways. Like, a friend of mine sort of made a funny comment, which was like, well, couldn't you kind of write the book without the Gurdjieff stuff? And I said, well, that's not what I wrote it to do that. But what she really meant, when we talked about what she meant, was like sort of less exposition and more of just like an autobiography, like a story. And she really responded to that. She thought it was very interesting. And I realized like there are different ways to kind of rewrite the book and rework it. So that's sort of what I'm interested in doing. You know, there's a writer, David Foster Wallace, who writes these. He's dead. He killed himself a couple of years ago. Quite a brilliant guy who wrote these huge novels. With Infinite Jest is one of his big works, and very philosophical. And he has huge footnotes all through his books, right? So you can read the story, but then you read the footnotes at the same time. And I was thinking I might David Foster Wallace, my first book, and kind of put more of the material, the exposition, into the footnotes, and sort of just tell the story by itself, you know, with some material, but from the fourth way, or some exposition, but a lot less, you know. So that's a way I was thinking of actually rewriting it. And I was actually thinking of sort of novelizing the first section, which was about the beginnings for us when we first became interested in the fourth way and started studying it, and just sort of what happened, the very strange quality of our lives. I think, you know, the idea of discovering the sleeping world, I think, is like to try to put that in like less of an exposition and more of a tell it as a novel. In the form of a novel, I think it is an interesting challenge, because it was a very distinct experience. It was quite amazing.
Yeah. It was amazing how we both so experienced the same thing.
Yeah, that was the most interesting part about it. It was like, if it had just been me, I would have doubted it. And if I think it had just been you, you might have had doubts about it. But because we both sort of saw the same thing, it was so reinforcing. And so it was kind of like we had this dialectic going on between us, and we kind of kept moving forward together, like in our dialogues. And it was just an extraordinary experience. Like, it really was. And it happened over a period of, like, I would say 3 to 5 years. The meaning of everything changed in that period. I just, you know, I can't believe it. In a way, like, you know, we didn't awaken, but there was sort of an awakening aspect of that. Like, we definitely awakened.
Yeah.
Yeah,
people, I think, have the wrong idea about, like, awakening. Or being, where they think it's like a monolith. Like, it's just one simple, like, you awake and then you're awake. And it's not like that. It's, you have level upon level of realizations, insights, awakenings, and it accumulates. And sometimes there are more dramatic shifts in consciousness. But people sometimes make it sound so simple. Like, they, you know, I've been enlightened, as though they're kind of fully enlightened. You know, and a person might have a very enlightening experience, but they're not enlightened as though they've attained Buddhahood or something, you know.
Yeah.
We can have enlightening experiences, but afterwards it may be very hard to retain any of the understanding or knowledge you gained in those experiences. It's not that it just becomes a permanent part of your being. It's like Gurdjieff says, if an ordinary person woke up, it would most likely drive them crazy, because it would kind of undermine all their familiar reality. And I think waking up and, you know, this whole thing, the kind of pursuit of self-knowledge, it's not a singular goal. It's an ongoing life process, and I believe, through different lives. Until ultimately maybe we can escape the cycle of life and death and death and rebirth.
Before you go on, I just wanted to say something in response to what you just said, which I think that's exactly right, what you were saying. I think that's very, very important. But also, I think when you begin to sort of awaken to certain things and you begin to see certain possibilities, then at the same time you're leading your life and things are going on, and you realize how things happen to you and how you don't really possess will and consciousness and everything, and you see how difficult it is to even wake up a little, but you have awakened to a certain extent. So it creates this very peculiar tension between what you see and what you understand in your life and about how you normally are and what you see as the possibilities if you really were able to awaken. And I think that's a very interesting aspect of awakening, is that tension between the two. It's the motive, in a way, that you have this dissonance between how you are and how you know you could be if you could actually awaken.
Yeah. That comment by Gurdjieff about awakening before you were ready, how a person, it would drive a person mad,
yeah,
in a way. It reminds me a little bit of what Karen and I went through when we woke up to kind of 9/11 and how it was a fraud, and then kind of unraveling more and more of these events in history had been staged, and false flag events, and it kind of opened up. We went through a very dramatic period there. Things I've never really shared, and I've just shared elements with a few people, but I think it took me years to kind of come down from that whole process we went through, and I know initially we experienced, at the same time we kind of experienced horror and fearfulness of what was going on. At the same time, it was like we felt rapture at times and bliss, and it was amazing what we experienced during those times. I still don't understand. I remember at one point I felt I had climbed the ladder of Jacob, and this was after I'd come back from doing the filming on Kabbalah with Guy Ritchie in L.A., and I'd studying Kabbalah more, and it was after that. And climbing the ladder of Jacob... The ladder of Jacob in Kabbalah is where you string four trees of life together, and they represent the four world orders: the world of the divine world of emanations, the spiritual world of creation, the psychical world of formation, and then the physical world made. So in Kabbalah, the idea is we have these four different interpenetrating world orders. And they say the central pillar of the tree of the ladder of Jacob, or the tree of life, represents levels of consciousness. So the idea is you want to ascend the central column through reconciling the opposites in your nature and to kind of dissolving the opposites, which releases the soul to kind of move up the central ladder. And I know during that period, I felt I had, at one point, I even wrote this in my writing on it, experienced divine realization. And, like, if I had to put in words what I realized now, I mean, it was an experience which I couldn't put in words. I put that label on it. I thought it was this kind of divine realization. I felt in such an exalted state. I felt I'd kind of climbed that ladder of realization. We went through an incredible period of time, Karen and I, through that period. And as I say, it was amazing. It kind of alternated between being feeling horror and sadness of what was going on, and at the same time experiencing these levels of kind of bliss and rapture. I still to this day, I'm struggling to understand all that we went through and put the pieces together again. But I know it kind of took me a long time to come down and be grounded again. And I think through at that time in my life, and as the time when we began studying Gurdjieff together, and the time during when I started studying Blavatsky's secret doctrine, and I felt I had revelations around that, because I kind of felt I experienced at one point what she was talking about in terms of creation dynamics, like immediate experience of it. So these were all kinds of periods of enlightenment and realization, but I would never claim myself to be enlightened now. It's not that, I had these realizations and enlightenments and then I'm enlightened. It's not like that. You know, it's so complex and subtle and layer upon layer, and these things are life processes. Like, we can look back now, we never would have had the personal experience and maturity 40 years ago to kind of understand the things we understand and talk about now. It's taken a life of study and experience to kind of come to these, to where we're at now. I mean, we're elders now. I think sometimes, I'm an elder now. Do I count as an elder? I'm over 60 and I've got 5 children, 1 grandchildren. I'm an elder, you know. So sometimes I take that, roll on a bit. I feel that. But and I can see why elders attain wisdom through their life in a way that you just can't have as a, cocky young man,
Yeah.
Anyway, it's been a process, and to have a mystical and spiritual perspective in life is just so incredibly valuable. And as our listeners probably realize, who from today or other shows, we have very different viewpoints on what's going on in society, and I don't want to get into that today, but Well, we don't know the answers. We're both kind of going along trying to understand these things. So anyway, I'm not sure where I was going. Oh, the other thing, Jim, I mentioned the idea that the next book I might publish was to be called God's Contracting Universe. And we'll go into a little bit of the background and of this, and you and I can discuss it a bit. And I must say, I'm still looking around for another title. I'm not, fixed on that.
Yeah.
But just to take the audience back a little bit, I think this was in the mid-80s that I read Carl Sagan's Broca's Brain, Reflections on the Romance of Science. And in his book, he has a chapter called A Sunday Sermon, which is about the issue of science and the existence of God. And Sagan, in his chapter, makes the point that as science advances, there seems less and less for God to do. In fact, that's the exact quote from Sagan, I think. He says, as science advances, there's less and less for God to do. And so my question was, is that true? What is it we think we've learnt in science which discounts the possibility of the existence of God? So to try to look critically at Sagan's statement on that issue. And that kind of led, at that point, I used Sagan as a contrast, a foil?
Foil.
Would you call it a foil? To bounce off? A foil.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we began, you and I had this concept of the problem of God's contracting universe. We've kind of had that kind of thought and question for 30 years now. And at one point I was even going to publish a book series under that title. I'm not sure if it was just a chapter. I've always had a chapter called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe.
I think it was
going to
be a book.
It was, 7-part book I was going to write.
Yeah.
At one point, when I was a university professor, and trying to demonstrate my possible contribution to the professional literature. I don't think anyone at the universe was too impressed when I showed them The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. I think I remember talking to David Bakken, elder statesman in the York department. He says, "You really think you can do this?" Well, and of course, I didn't know I could, but I saw the first steps to it, because what I did see was the vacuity or the emptiness of Sagan's arguments and the simplicity of them, and how he really knew nothing about what the mystics really say. He was basing it on like mainly he would argue against the straw men of fundamental Christianity or fundamentalist belief, but he didn't really understand what the deeper esoteric or mystical teachings taught. So at that point then, I abandoned that title I split my work up in alternate ways. And then several years ago, as Jim mentioned earlier, he started writing a book about my work through my life and his own work, because we've worked together now for 40 years, and he entitled this book about, like, trying, I think, Jim, you're trying a way to be an impartial observer, in a way trying to separate from my work, like, on one side, and trying to relate that to science and science philosophy on the other hand, and I think you're trying to be in that middle position a bit. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I say that, and at the same time, I admit that, as, like, you know, I try to sort of adopt a posture of some objectivity and impartiality, but at the same time, I mean, I know that I've been your friend and collaborator and editor and played more than a passing part in some of the development of some of the ideas. So, I mean, in a sense, like, you know, I'm not impartial and I'm not objective, but I do try to stand back a little bit and try to, I'm trying to put this in the broader context of things. And what I'm really basically trying to do is provide an exposition of the essentials of what you are arguing and the model of consciousness that you're creating. And at the same time, I'm trying to relate that to issues in the philosophy of science and the history of science, and trying to provide it, and also in terms of the debate between religion and science, and trying to provide a broader context. Like, in a way, part of what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to identify that what you're outlining is really a third perspective on the science versus religion debate. That in a way, it's, in Gurdjieff's terms, it's formatory, it's simplistic, because it's science versus religion, and really it's not a real debate. And where that becomes so obvious is through the understanding of esotericism, as to, in terms of how it is different from religion, different from science, but has something important to say to both religion and science. So that's, you know, it's the reconciling force, and that's what I would say is a phony debate between science and religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think your work really, I think that's where your work is so valuable, because I think that's where, you know, it just highlights all of the assumptive framework that underlines that debate, but also it identifies like all these critical assumptions and conventions that people have adopted in terms of our understanding of consciousness, and that's really the huge unanswered question in all of this, which affects everything. Like, our conceptualization of consciousness, even our unstated assumptions about consciousness, just seems, it colors everything, and once we understand that, it changes everything. It changes the meaning of everything. And you know, it's a very complex process, but that's what I'm trying to do through your work. And that's also, like, it's an exposition of what you're actually arguing, because in and of itself, these are very profound ideas.
Yeah, it's hard for people to appreciate just how alternative some of the concepts are. Like, the concept that we have zero-point centers. It is like, I don't know anyone else kind of arguing or presenting that. People touch on aspects of it, like, but not in as direct a way. And the manner in which I say there's a higher dimensional physics to the holographic physics to the human heart, like, that's a profound concept. It's a legitimate scientific hypothesis. I think one of the real insights that I had early on into the issue of the problem of God's contracting universe, as you say, it kind of relates to the issue of consciousness, because how I saw it was that the issue of the existence of God ties into the issue of the existence of the human soul, and the idea that a human being has a soul is a corollary of the God hypothesis. Would you say, like, philosophically, Jim, is that the right terminology? I think it is. It's
a corollary. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that is. Yeah, that's one way of expressing it. Definitely, I think it's an important way to think of it too.
Yeah, I do too.
You can take it a little bit a step further. It's just like the whole idea of a soul implies, like, some sort of existence of a spiritual element within us, or the reality of spiritual dimensions, and you know, those are even bigger questions.
Yeah, And I've never heard anyone else in the science and religion debate even raise the issue of the significance of the question of the origin and nature of consciousness. Like, they don't seem to see the connection. I mean, I think another corollary of the God hypothesis is the idea that we live in a multidimensional universe and that we are multidimensional beings and can exist after life and within other subtle planes. I mean, that's another corollary, I would say, of the God hypothesis. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I think Ken Wilber has talked about in his book, The Marriage of Sense and Soul, and I think in One Eye also he talks about this, but he talks about the collapse of the great chain of being and as a central concept in people's thinking throughout the ages, and it's only really in the last couple of hundred years that has collapsed, and that the idea of the hierarchy of being, and that we live in a universe of hierarchies of being has been done away with, and what the consequences are of that. And then the parallel is that we've done away with it in terms of human consciousness and human experience, and so everything has been reduced to the flat land of physical science and the flat land of modern psychology. And really, what you are arguing in your model is that we are multidimensional beings and we live in a multidimensional universe, and that there's some sort of isomorphic parallels between the structure of human consciousness and the structure of this of the multidimensional nature of the universe, and that's a very radical conceptualization, but it's a very ancient one also too, as above, so below, and man is the microcosm and the macrocosm. These are very profound formulations of very deep ideas, and again, like, nobody in modern psychology or science, when they're talking about consciousness, even comes anywhere near discussing this. Nobody. I mean, it just I'd say somebody like Wilber does, but I'd say almost any academic theorist, nobody gives any attention to this at all.
Yeah, it's amazing. I agree. They don't seem to give recognition to it. Like, if you follow our line of reasoning that the soul hypothesis is a corollary of the soul notion is a corollary of the God hypothesis, and the idea of a multidimensional universe is a corollary of the God hypothesis, well, then you start realizing that in ways there is scientific evidence for multidimensional existence, and that includes all the evidences for all the paranormal phenomena, especially near-death experiences, which I think are a very profound area of study.
Yes.
We've talked about before, as well as all other kinds of instances of ghosts and possessions and poltergeists, and all of these phenomena have been studied by serious investigators, and you might find faults in aspects of their studies, as you could find fault in the aspects of anybody's studies, even in the mainstream, but still, these were serious scientific investigators, and there's a wealth of evidence documenting paranormal phenomena which are completely incompatible with the existing scientific assumptive framework that we're only material biological beings. Like, so in a way, I often see scientists, in a way, they're the most pseudo-scientific, because they don't, to dismiss something, you have to learn what is being said, and you have to weigh it impartially and arrive at, sensible criticisms and such. And that's what I don't see. Instead, what I see is kind of arbitrary dismissal of all this really vast body of literature. So in a way, I remember in Montreal about 5 years ago, I was asked to participate in a conference on the issues of science and religion. And I fortunately got to speak last. And I began by saying, well, firstly, we don't know what science is. Mostly, I think of what we think is science, I think is quack science. Like, including, I would say, Darwinian evolutionary theory. I think is quack science to think that it is proven. Now, it's not quack science as a hypothesis or a theoretical framework of ideas. Like, that's legitimate. But to assume that that's been established when there are so many unknowns and missing links and such, that becomes quack science, to present that as the conclusion of science. It's that jump of faith on their part, which is just as great a jump of faith as someone else might have to believe in the existence of God. So in my presentation to this, first I went through science and trying to show how most of what I think is normal science is really quack science, because they ignore all the evidences for the paranormal. They don't have any idea what consciousness is. So in a way, I see, and they have this materialistic perspective, which has never been proven, but is simply an assumptive framework. And science doesn't advance by making assumptions. I mean, assumptions are useful as in a stage of scientific inquiry, but you can't, you know, your scientific conclusions can't be based upon assumptions. And so much of the science philosophy is based on assumptions. Not that the hard science is, because most hard scientists don't really deal with the kind of epistemological and aspects of their own work. But most scientists are involved in the study of fairly isolated phenomena within some department of knowledge. I mean, it's more the science philosophy, which I say is more the bad guy, not science. I mean, I consider myself to be a scientist. I'm interested in objective science. And so then I talked about religion and said how most of what we think of religion isn't really religion, because mainly people know form of religion. And there, all the religions are different. They all have different names for God and different practices and different prayers and different concepts of afterlife and so on. So if you take religions on a superficial level, you'd say, well, they're all contradictory and can't all be right. But if you then look at the esoteric side of religion, and in the esoteric side of religion, I say that religions share some of the same fundamental principles. And most importantly, the heart doctrine, that God is connected to a human being through the physics or the mechanism somehow of the human heart. And how we find this all throughout the mystical literature, whether it's the Sufi Rumi searching for God and can't find God anywhere, until he says finally he finds him in his only place, within mine own heart. And whether it's a Sufi or it's a Dalai Lama or it's a Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita who says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. So I think what people think is religion, in a way, I think that that's kind of pseudo-religion, because I think religions, all of them too much, have missed the esoteric teachings of their own religion. So in a way, what I was trying to point out is we don't understand what science is, we don't understand what religion is, at least in the popular arguments and discourse over these subjects. And then it kind of lays the way open. I think, like, I operate the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. So my purpose in that is to firstly, bring a mystical and spiritual perspective to bear on the findings of science. That's one side of it. So what I try to do is point out how Blavatsky in 1888 was suggesting the creation out of nothingness, the modern equivalent of vacuum genesis, and Blavatsky was describing the universe originating from a point source, the equivalent of a modern singularity, and Blavatsky was saying there's seven-dimensional eternal parent space, which is the equivalent of modern seven-dimensional hyperspace. So what I'm, the first step, see, is trying to look at ideas drawn from mystical and spiritual teachings and compare them to science. And there, I think there are profound similarities that scientists have arrived at many of the same notions that mystics have articulated for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. I love that quote from the Jonathan Cott book, where he's talking to Rabbi Kushner, can you recall?
Yeah, Rabbi
Krishna. You don't have that handy, that quote from that?
I can get it. Where he's talking about the origins, modern cosmologists have hypothesized that the origin of the universe is a point source, or it's a single point of light, and Rabbi Kushner says something to the effect that, a single point of light, and talks about Moses, somebody in the De Leon in the 14th century, a rabbi was talking about exactly the same thing.
Which is shocking. People dismiss the significance of it, but I believe we shouldn't do that. And also, it's that the mystics arrived, in my view, at these concepts through direct experiences. And then, of course, if they teach other people or write them down, then the concepts are passed on. But I would say that that's the kind of mystical origin of the idea. My point is, so part of the equation is looking at mystical ideas from a scientific viewpoint, as well as looking at the findings of science from a mystical perspective, because I think that's a fascinating process, because I think there are many theories and notions in science, all of which confirm what mystics have taught. Another example would be in modern physics, how now it's been accepted what's called action at a distance, or non-local effects. And that's come out as an integral part of quantum theory. And then you look back in 1888, and Blavatsky was saying, ultimately, there is no effect which does not involve action at a distance. And she even uses that term, action at a distance. You know what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. That was his phrase for it. So there are astonishing similarities. And that doesn't prove mysticism, but what it does is suggest that, you know, we need to look seriously at what is said by these great mystics, look seriously at those ideas as scientific hypotheses, and see if we can relate them to the newest concepts in science. Because what I see now is that as science advances, it's getting even more and more complex, like how they construe the basic nature of matter and energy and time and space. Like the newest concepts of science, you know, as I've written about, like the black holes in higher dimensional space and how they can be rendered equivalent to particle physics and things like that, I won't go into. But all these ideas, in my view, instead of discounting mystical ideas, I think it gives us extra reason to pay attention to them, because there are such vast unknowns, even within science itself.
Yeah, especially I want to go back to something that you mentioned about when you were talking about God and the soul hypothesis. And when in Sagan's, I think it's actually in a Sunday sermon, but it's definitely in Broca's Brain, I believe it is actually in Sunday sermon, he says something to the effect that when he's talking to people and he's asking them about their beliefs in God, and he said when people tell him that they believe in God, he asks them, well, what does that mean? And they said, well, you know, I believe in God. And he the point he's making is that when we say that we believe in God, we have to have some sort of understanding of what God is to say that we believe in it. And he said, you know, this is a big question. It's like, you know, what exactly do you mean when you say you believe in God? And I think that's a very good point. Like, that's, you know, that needs to be examined. That needs to be explored. It's one thing to say, oh, I believe in God because I was, you know, raised as a Presbyterian and you know, it was inculcated in me through repetition and going to Sunday school and church that I believed in God. That's what I was taught. But, you know, what does that mean? And then at another point, he's talking about belief in God, and he says that that when it, in terms of God, he said, well, he said that he contrasted that the God of Spinoza and Einstein, which is essentially God is a name, a concept to label all of the natural laws that govern the universe. And then he said, but he said, I don't know of any compelling evidence for the existence of a bearded patriarch who overlooks creation and keeps tabs on something to that effect. But it would be madness to destroy. It would be madness to deny the existence of the natural laws that govern the universe. So that's his kind of definition of what the choices are in God. It's either the Einstein and Spinoza's God, which is the natural laws that govern the universe, or it's a bearded patriarch who sits up in heaven on his throne, and it's a white guy, and he looks down, and he keeps tab on creation by telling the angels to push and pummel the planets. That's one of Sagan's things, or to micro-intervene and tell morning glories to open, because that's another one of his examples. And I mean, the whole thing is completely ludicrous. His choices, it's formatory in Gurdjieff's terms. It's a false dichotomy. Like, obviously there were other choices in believing in God than that, but one of the things that I say in the introduction to the problems of God's contracting universe is that, in a way, your examination of this problem, and it was the original label for you were going to do 8 volumes on this, and it was like 1979 when you first started this, and you were going to write 8 volumes examining the sciences, the pseudosciences, paranormal research, and the esoteric, mystical literature to examine this question of whether or not it's true that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do. And
yeah, that,
in a way, like what I argue is that at the beginning of the book is that in a way, I think your examination of this question leads to the idea that there are spiritual realities and that there is a God, but in a sense, like, it makes the concept of God that much more difficult to determine. Like, I would say that the God that you're describing, the God Blavatsky talks about, it's indefinable. There is something which all of our the constructions of our language are inadequate to define or conceive of God. Like, God is beyond all. God is a plenum and God is a void. You know, it's like all the paradoxes of the contrast between these different terms, the paradoxes that these terms exist within God, like these supposed opposites. So God is, in a sense, is indefinable. But then there are different manifestations of God. So there's the Godhead, like there's the Holy Trinity, and then then God propagates it through these different world orders and through the operation of the, in Gurdjieff terms, the laws of 3 and 7, the 3 gunas in the Hindu teachings, or the 3 zazahad and the 3 hidden splendors in Kabbalah, or the Christian Trinity, like that. So there, you know, the workings of God are conceivable and are we can extrapolate and we can describe them as we can the natural laws of science. But even like the natural laws of science, we know what electricity and magnetism, we know their effects, and we can conceive of them, we can extrapolate them, but we don't really know what electricity is. We don't know what magnetism is. We don't know what gravity is. You know, we can describe their effects, we can conceive of them as forces, but we don't know what they are.
No. The more we come to the most basic questions, we end up in ignorance. Like, there's an unfathomable mystery still remains.
Which is quite, I mean, it's quite wonderful in a way. Oh, by the way, here is the Jonathan Cott Rabbi Kushner conversation. Jonathan Cott is an interviewer and writer who interviewed Rabbi Kushner. It's not the Rabbi Kushner who said, all I ever needed to know, I learned in kindergarten. There is a Rabbi Kushner there, and they actually live in the same town. This is Rabbi Kushner who writes about Kabbalah and esotericism. Jonathan Cott says, cosmologists have speculated that at the first explosive moment of the birth of the universe, everything that exists or ever will exist was contained within a single spark of energy, smaller than an atom's nucleus, and ruled by a single primordial law. And Rabbi Kushner says, one dot, a point of light. Perhaps the fact that contemporary cosmologists talk about a dimensionless point of light from which all beings sprang, and that the Kabbalists long ago came up with precisely the same image, and then in brackets, in the 14th century, Moses de Leon spoke of a hidden supernal point whose primal center is the innermost light of translucence, subtlety, and purity beyond comprehension, close the bracket, means that this awareness comes from something we all carry within us. We're walking Torahs, if we could just shut up and listen to it. As Rabbi Dov Ber of Mezrich said, I shall teach you the best way to say Torah. You must cease to be aware of yourselves. You must be nothing but an ear which hears what the universe of the world is constantly saying within you.
Wow, yeah, it's a beautiful quote.
Yeah, it is. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I mean, the 14th century, this rabbi was talking about, you know, a dimensionalist point of light, this subtlety, a supernal point of light. I mean, it's amazing. It's like that's 600 years before modern cosmologists discovered that the origins of the universe and from the Big Bang, you know, and the singularity.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. I remember one of the scientists who came up with the idea of vacuum genesis. And he described it. He said, well, it was almost like a mystical experience. And I had this vision of the universe kind of emerging out of nothingness and kind of everything adding up to nothing. And he had this in a vision or dream. And he would say, oh, of course, there's nothing mystical about it. But that's his assumption, because from our perspective, wow, he had a legitimate, like, objective dream, kind of revealing this to him. And usually you have these kinds of dreams when you focus on a subject and you learn about it and contemplate and meditate it, and then things can dream. It was funny reading his account of how he discovered the idea of vacuum genesis. And then it's so funny is that scientists think that they discovered the idea of vacuum genesis. And in a way, the basic notion of vacuum genesis is in the first book of Genesis, because it says, in the beginning, the earth was empty and void, which makes it sound as though nothing existed. And the Spirit of God moved across the face of the water, which shows a kind of pre-existing spirit representing the Divine Father moving across the face of the water, which represents the Divine Mother in mystical teachings. So even in the book of Genesis, we had this notion of creation out of nothingness. And it's an ancient Christian idea. It was called creation ex nihilo, or ex nihilo. How would you pronounce that?
Nihilo,
sorry?
Yeah, I think Nihilo.
Nihilo. Creation ex nihilo.
Creation out of nothing.
Yeah. It's the same scientists are just so dismissive of mystical teachings, paranormal phenomena, paranormal research, because it's often... You look at Kuhn's book on the structure of scientific revolutions, and he talks about how science progresses for a certain period of time within a kind of fixed paradigm, and that directs people's inquiries and researches. But then he says you begin to accumulate inexplicable phenomena which can't be explained in terms of the existing framework. And he says, and then these kind of inexplicable phenomena accumulate, and then all of a sudden they kind of wash away the old way of thinking, and there's the emergence of a new paradigm. And I think that's the potential that is there in science now. I think that, I wish we had more physicists and hard scientists who took seriously the ideas of paranormal research, and instead of saying, oh, it couldn't happen or it couldn't work, instead think differently and ask themselves, how could it work? Like, assuming in a way it is existent, it is real, how could we account for that? I mean, that I think that's been my orientation now for 30 years, because 30 years ago, I became convinced that out-of-body experiences occur, because I had my own, and I'd read about numerous other people's. But when you have your own, it's even harder to deny. And the more I looked at the research on paranormal phenomena, especially near-death experiences, the more I was convinced that these people are legitimate scientists. I remember Sabon's research on recollections of death. And he tried to follow. He was a skeptic when he did his study of near-death experiences. And it was a small sample, but very competently researched. And he kind of found there was no way to account for these phenomena within the existing framework. Like, there was an honest scientist, in my view. And yeah. It's a shame scientists see they dismiss the concepts even before they make the effort to think it out and to use their serious scientific methods to inquire into these phenomena. I think there are many things emerging in the new physics which just give more and more possible basis for paranormal phenomena.
It's interesting that Sabin started that way, but Raymond Moody actually started that way, who really kind of kicked off, really had the most influential book about it in the mid-70s about the near-death experience, life after life, and he was a skeptic at the beginning, and Kenneth Ring, the psychologist who's done very interesting work, was also a skeptic, and it's funny how, you know, these are people who are honest enough to look at things with an open mind, even though they didn't believe it. You know, they didn't believe it was a real phenomenon, or that they could, if they studied it, they could provide a natural explanation for it. And that's really like that's the big thing, is that if you really question the assumptive framework which underlies so many of the ideas in modern psychology and modern science, then you realize that our understanding of things, you know, that there are it's very realistic to question whether or not these things are providing comprehensive explanations. They don't provide comprehensive explanations, but even that they could be fundamentally wrong about the most basic things. It could be fundamentally wrong that the universe just didn't arise because of a random fluctuation in the quantum vacuum. I mean, as Bernard Haich, the former editor of the Journal of Astrophysics, says in his book, The God Theory, the evidence for that is precisely zero. Exactly right. Nobody was there. Nobody observed it. You know, it's a construction. And the same thing can be said of consciousness. It's quite reasonable to assume that the human brain generates consciousness, and it's become a convention and an unquestioned assumption that consciousness somehow, even though nobody has any clue as to how this happens, somehow is being produced by the human brain. But within the mystical and esoteric tradition, this is a well-understood illusion, and there's an alternative explanation. So it's entirely reasonable to question the self-evident truth that consciousness produces brain, the brain is produced by consciousness. And then when you really do examine this question in any kind of detail with an open mind, you see that the evidence that that proposition is incorrect is actually quite overwhelming. And the reason why nobody's been able to prove it is because it's not true. And so, you know, what I've always kind of admired in your approach to things is to take that tack, which is very scientific, which is to say, well, let's assume, you know, it's called thinking outside of the box. Let's assume rather than needing to prove these things, that they are already true. Let's work backwards. How could it possibly work? You know, and that leads to a very different approach to the study of things. There's a great quote here. I got this great book on UFOs called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record by Leslie Keene, who's a journalist who studied this for 10 years and has written this very intriguing-looking book I just begun. And she quotes Arthur Schopenhauer, the philosopher, at the beginning. All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as self-evident. Which is, you know, so true, huh? I mean, that's quite amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Sagan says at one point in his writings, you know, they laughed at Einstein, they laughed at Newton, they laughed at Bozo the Clown, you know, and his point is like, well, just because, you know, ideas have been ridiculed in the past and turned out to be true doesn't mean that, you know, every ridiculous idea is going to end up being a self-evident truth. I mean, there are all sorts of dumb ideas and silly ideas out there about things. But the point is that really the real breakthroughs in science always occur, like in Kuhn's terms, the paradigm shifts occur when somebody upends the assumptive framework and comes at a problem, it comes at an area of knowledge, and tries to understand those anomalies and those enigmas and mysteries that don't fit within that perspective, and provides a new perspective which will incorporate or which will more effectively address those questions from a theoretical perspective. So, you know, that's what I think is the situation here, is I think the Hart Doctrine is a fundamentally different way of looking at the problem of the nature of consciousness, that the great mystery of the nature of consciousness, and it's one that's, you know, I don't know if it's correct. I think it is correct, but I say that mainly because I think there's been a lot of research done on it by people throughout thousands of years in different laboratories called different esoteric schools in different places. But even if it's not true, I just think it suggests like an entirely different way of thinking of things, which is very useful, because what it really does, more than anything else, it exposes the arbitrary nature of many of the conventions that govern consciousness research and theories now, and I think really show how inadequate they are to really deal with the reality of something that complex and mysterious.
I think the Hart Doctrine also gives us a perspective in which we could explain certain phenomena that are otherwise left unexplained.
Yeah.
Like, I think in my own studies of consciousness, over time, I realized, in a way, just how bizarre this is, the notion that our consciousness or awareness of being is all centered up in our mind, in our heads.
Hmm.
Because in my direct experience of myself, that is not at all how I experience myself. So it's like direct experiential evidence suggests otherwise. I mean, that doesn't mean it's true, but it doesn't mean it's false. I mean, and it's just like that pointing game where I get people to point at things, and then I say, point to yourself, and most people point towards the heart or the throat more. And it's very rare do people point to their heads to indicate themselves. And why is that? If our consciousness and mind and the self are all up in the head, why isn't everybody pointing to their heads? But they don't. And because that's not how people experience life for themselves. And another example I think is really important has to do with love and the heart. Like how modern scientists think that, you know, emotions are created by the limbic system and the fornix body and the amygdala and such. But how many people go home and say, "Dear, I love you with all my head"? You know, people know intuitively that love has to do with the heart. And you can feel heartbroken, you can feel heart loss, you can feel emptiness in the heart. Even this notion of emptiness in the heart.
Yeah.
You think of the profound things we've discussed about the Zimzum contraction in Kabbalah, eh? Where God kind of creates a vacant space. He withdraws his infinite energies from a vacated space within the heart. So in a way, there's a form of nothingness at the heart of being, which is like, and that's in Kabbalah. And it's a profound, profound idea that I believe corresponds to experiential evidences of people's accounts of their own experience. And it's in their own language. Going through grief myself, I don't just feel it up in my head, kind of. I feel it within my heart. You see, I think we've got this kind of completely fanciful notions that have arisen in modern psychology. There is no modern psychology of the heart. The only psychology of the heart is the emphasis on, like, what are those factors that contribute to heart disease or, you know, AB personality types, things along that line. That there's a little bit of that in psychology, but there's no psychology of the heart. No mainstream psychologists think that the heart is really a feeling, sensing, living entity. And yet, that is what people's own experience and language, and it's in poetry, it's in music, It's like that quote I like so much from Papa Bush, that I, which is a heavy metal band that I have on my site. And the lines go, I hope I can remember them. Tell them what you heard. It's about a revolution in your heart and in your mind, because everything is nothing, and nothingness is in everything. And this reality is just a effed up dream, to censor my language, an effed up dream. Turn it inside out, it's a big black hole. And they have this in their lyrics. And in a way, it's such a profound concept that they, in their lyrics, are saying there's this kind of big black hole in the heart. And they, I don't think they've ever studied mystical teachings. I mean, I have no idea. But I think it comes from their direct, intuitive, poetic experience. And you know, they don't realize that their notions actually have some scientific merit. At least in my view, they do. So it's a whole area that I think modern science, they've dehumanized man in a way, you know, in terms of viewing us only as material biological beings. And it's, you know, I think our work leads to the re-enchantment of nature, or the re-enchantment of human beings, that we're not simply soulless beings. There's something, there's a deep mysteries to be solved about the nature of the human heart. And it's a profound way of thinking. And, you know, it's something we have both grown through. Like, I've been articulating this for 20 to 30 years. I wouldn't say I know 100% it's true. I still don't even feel that. You know, I try to keep my mind open and consider all possibilities. And it's hard to ever believe you arrive at final truths, in the sense I'm not like that. But what I have arrived at is the view that this perspective on the issues of consciousness is the most complete account that could potentially explain and allow us to understand other phenomena. And so, I mean, it's a scientific issue, and it continues to be, and I continue to research it myself. I want to learn more about the heart and heart transplants and, you know, all other evidences that bear upon these issues. So it's been a long process. We were talking about the problem of God's contracting universe, and we went back to the kind of early formulations of that issue, and then I guess what happened to me more recently was waking up to the defeats of 9/11 and all these terrible things that I feel are going on in the world. I felt, oh, here's God's contracting universe, not as an issue in terms of the advancement of science or the issues of science and religion, but here it is in terms of human morality and what's happening on the planet. It's like the planet's descending more and more into kind of darkness and chaos, and more wars and conflicts. So that's a kind of new meaning for me of what I mean by God's contracting universe. Less the academic side, but just what's happened to us morally and spiritually as a people.
Well, people have become heartless.
So I think that is kind of a new chapter on the same theme, but in a quite different area.
People have become heartless.
Yeah, people have, in a way, they can lose heart. I saw this a lot with offenders I dealt with. I remember hearing stories from offenders and where they would be like aggressive or mean to children or other people, and I'm like, how could you do such things? And I remember feeling like you have to not have a heart. I mean, people even say that, like, have a heart, you know, have some compassion. And I realized with the men, like, I was teaching anger management and things, and I realized like how mystics describe the heart contraction. And that the more and more you become contracted about the heart, then the more your focus centers on the ego in the mind, in the head. And you become like an egomaniac. And a lot of offenders were like that. It's like their basic life feeling connected to their heart, and they're capacity for feeling towards other people becomes more and more limited as due to the heart contraction. And so that's why, you know, working with criminal offenders, I developed a new approach to offender rehabilitation called Awakening of Consciousness and the Heart in Criminal Offenders. I had no opportunity to evaluate the effectiveness of my program because I was in an institute where everybody had cognitive behavior modification. It's a new way of thinking that has real applications, I think, in counseling and group work and such. And I think, as you say, like, we have become a heartless nation. Like, you know, here we are, like, as American forces, you know, we're over in the Middle East and the horrible destruction and death and loss and orphans and homeless people and depleted uranium, all these horrendous things. It's like, and when we call ourselves a Christian nation, or, I mean, we don't anymore. I mean, not to call yourself a Christian anything, but just in the world, like, what's happened to humankind? It's like all these noble ideas, and you look at the life of humankind, and it's like we've lost heart. I mean, that's what I think in the world today. I mean, I believe the only way to change the world is through awakening of human consciousness and the heart. And I believe that's the next step in human evolution. And it all makes sense in terms of, like, even Gurdjieff's cosmic octave, how most people are men number 1, 2, or 3, sounding the cosmic do, re, or mi, but they don't get to the next level, which is the opening of the fourth center, or the heart chakra. And that's where I is. So people don't get to that level, and they lose heart. And they lose heart, and they sink into addictions and violence and such. It's funny, even in corrections, everybody thinks, you know, that these offenders have mental disorders. But I never saw it that way. I always thought the fundamental disorders were emotional. It had to do with the heart. And the contraction of their heart as they're traumatized through their youth. And that heart feeling is still there and latent in people. And all it needs is to be reawakened and the kind of support to allow that. So I noticed, Jim, we're down. We've only got 3 or 4 minutes. Any kind of concluding thoughts or comments?
We just sort of touched on the beginning of the heart doctrine today, but I mean, maybe next time when we talk, we can talk a little bit about like when you actually mentioned earlier about the holographic dimensions of the heart, the higher dimensions of the heart and everything. And it's not just this idea that consciousness arises in the heart, but and not generated by the brain, which is so profound, but it's all of the metaphysical and the cosmological aspects of how consciousness arises in the heart. But it's so profound because it really enlarges the world within. You realize it's like that quote from the Chandogya, I don't even know how you pronounce it, Chandogya, it's an Upanishad, where it says the universe within is within the heart is as great as that without. And I think that's such a profound statement. I found this great quote, I don't even know where I found it, I wrote it down on a piece of paper, but I don't know where I found it, from Plotinus, where he says, we are within a reality that is within us, which is so kind of profound, and I think flows exactly from this perspective. So maybe next time we could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, good. I mean, we always come back to the heart doctrine, the zero point teaching. Like, if someone listened to all our different shows, they'd hear some of the same material over and over again, but always slightly different. And it's like you grow in understanding of it.
Yeah,
you grow in understanding of it over time. Yeah, and that's really important. Okay, so we just got a minute here. We'll be back in 2 weeks, Jim. I'll most likely be at home at that time. I hope you may make it up sometime to visit.
Yeah, I will be up at some point, because we're doing a case and I have to go to Ottawa to meet a guy so on business, so I definitely will be coming up in the next little while.
Yeah, great, good. Yeah. And
have a safe trip, an enjoyable one.
Yeah, I will. It's been really good for me, and I think I can get home and kind of break out a bit of the kind of depressive spell. I mean, I've kept going, and grieving's an amazing process, and there's even an ecstasy in it, one goes through a lot with loss, and I certainly have an idea, a feeling of Karen being with me at different times. I was sitting by a lake yesterday about to go in for a swim, and I had this great big, huge blue dragonfly land on my shoe. The dragonfly was always Karen's symbol, eh? And I just thought, oh, that's Karen. She's here with me. And one never knows. Okay, thanks, Jim. Thank you, BBS Radio. I would encourage people to visit my website at www.zeropoint.ca. And I believe my most important work is the Heart Doctrine book. And it's a book I'm sure you'll treasure and can pick and read here and there, and I hope will deepen your life. Okay, bless you all. Thanks for listening. And this is Christopher. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Goodbye.